You're listening to a Truly Criminal podcast exclusive. This episode contains themes that some listeners may find distressing. Listener discretion is advised. Today's Truly Criminal podcast exclusive takes us back to the year 1992 and the city that never sleeps, New York City. In the early 90s, New York was still struggling with the financial crisis of the 80s, the AIDS epidemic, and boiling racial tensions. In the late 80s and early 90s, violent crime had soared to an all-time high, and the Big Apple had recorded its worst ever murder statistics during this tumultuous period, with a staggering 2,245 murders being committed in the year 1990 alone. The sound of gunfire had become so commonplace in the city that police dispatchers stopped sending patrol cars out to reports of it unless someone was injured. The overall morale of officers was at an all-time low, and some hardened police precincts even started to bitterly state that the New York motto should be, "You give us 22 minutes, we'll give you a homicide."
This is Eyewitness News with Bill Buetel.
Good evening. It is Christmas Eve in New York, and the talk of the town is not peace on earth, but the violence among us.
Good evening, everyone. If you ride the subways, tonight's news is not so good. Subway crime has hit an all-time high, according to the transit police.
A man was shot twice in the chest on a number 6 train in Upper
Manhattan.
Two suspects ran out of the station at 125th Street and Lexington Avenue. They were arrested by housing police.
The victim is in serious condition tonight. And this was not the only example of violent subway crime.
An unidentified man was stabbed and robbed Sunday morning at the 66 and Broadway subway station. Just another example of the growing crime wave. Transit police blames it on a new wave of younger, hardened criminals.
I thought it was an unwinnable battle, NYPD Chief of Detectives Robert Boyce said of his time working the city's streets and fighting the ever-increasing crime rate in the early 90s. Around this same time, New Yorkers also bore witness to a large number of high-profile and infamous cases, such as the highly controversial Central Park jogger case, the Bernhard Goetz trial, and the very public execution of mafia godfather Paul Castellano, who was shot to death outside the popular eatery Spark Steakhouse in Midtown Manhattan in 1986.
He died on an empty stomach. And because it happened that way, the theory is the biggest mafia rubout of the decade took place with considerable help from inside the dead mobster's family. 6 shell casings were on the pavement of East 46th Street, right next to the body of Paul Castellano Sr., the top mafiosi in the United States, the heir to the Gambino family, indeed the son-in-law of the late Carlo Gambino, on trial for conspiracy and racketeering in a case stemming from an alleged auto theft ring. 10 feet away, Castellano's driver and bodyguard, 45-year-old Thomas Bellotti, the keys to his late model limousine, not far from his hand. It was last February that Big Paul Castellano refused to comment on his indictment on racketeering charges. Back then, he posted $2 million bail. Tonight, police would not say if Castellano was on his way to dinner at the restaurant outside which he was gunned down, though Castellano was known to visit many of the city's better eateries.
Just 2 weeks ago at his federal trial, a witness said of Castellano that the reputed mafia chief had objected to particularly brutal methods to be used in a mob-style hit. Now Castellano himself is the victim of such a hit. The question is whether his death will spark a new mafia war in New York or be the end of one.
The mafia had long been a fixture in New York's dark underworld and contributed heavily to the crime statistics, with sex work, racketeering, loan sharking, extortion, drug dealing and murder all being part and parcel of their business. Despite a devastating government crackdown on the mob led by the then US attorney Rudy Giuliani that resulted in a large number of mafia bosses and soldiers being sentenced to lengthy prison terms, the mafia kept its stranglehold over the 5 boroughs.
NBC News reported today that 5 leaders of the New York City Mafia are about to be indicted on racketeering and other charges. Word is indictments will be handed down against the leaders of New York's 5 major crime families believed responsible for most of New York City's organized crime. A federal grand jury is now reportedly listening to hours of those mafia tapes.
Mr. Slotnick, what do you think of the indictment against your clients and the other 7 defendants?
Well, my clients...
The commission charges a series of violent crimes and a series of extortions.
It appears that the indictment is a rehash of some old books that have been around for a while, which have now been formalized into criminal charges. I think the government will be very hard-pressed to prove this before a fair and impartial jury, and I think ultimately my clients will be walking down that courthouse steps free.
In 1992, the boss of the largest mafia family in New York City, the Gambino family, was John Gotti Sr., the mastermind behind the Paul Castellano assassination. In April of 92, he had been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, and his son, John Gotti Jr., was reportedly running the crime family for his father.
Good evening, I'm Bill Butel, and John Gotti knows it all too well tonight. After a six-year crusade to bring him down, the government's case stuck to him like glue. Tonight, John Gotti stands convicted, found guilty on every count against him, and the top dog in the country's most powerful crime family can only look at the moon through jailhouse bars. The jailhouse gates rumble down as a prison van carries John Gotti to a future behind bars. Prosecutors say, "Don voyage," goodbye to John Gotti, who's headed now for the prison yard.
The Teflon is gone, the Don is covered with Velcro, and every charge in the indictment stuck.
He was guilty of the murder of Paul Castellano, of the murder of Robert DiBernardo, guilty, of the murder of Louis Melito, guilty, and of the murder of Louis De Bono, guilty.
The prosecution team that put John Gotti behind bars for the rest of his life had plenty to celebrate in a high-stakes gamble that pitted the integrity of the nation's judicial system against organized crime. The Justice Department came up aces. It all started right here, a blood-soaked street on the east side where former Gambino godfather Paul Castellano was gunned down on Gotti's order in a brazen storm of gunfire in December of 1985.
It was during this time of upheaval and uncertainty that the mafia again found themselves under fire. However, this time it wasn't from the government, the FBI, or rival criminal organisations. The attacks were coming from John Gotti's old stomping ground of Queens, in the guise of two rebellious young lovers, who the media would later dub Bonnie and Clyde, and who would go on to inspire at least two Hollywood movies based on their lives, Rob the Mob and The Wannabe. Their names were Thomas and Rosemary Hoover. Thomas Hoover was born in the Bronx on May 17, 1964, to parents Anthony and Fanny. Anthony Hoover was a florist, with his own flower shop on East Tremont Avenue. The business often struggled, and Thomas helped his father with the shop when he wasn't at school during his childhood. He liked the smell of the store and enjoyed sweeping away the cuttings from the floor while his father chatted to customers from around the neighbourhood. However, it was believed that whilst working with his father in the shop, this small and quiet boy often witnessed his father being threatened and extorted by members of the local mafia for protection money. These experiences would lead Thomas to have a lifelong love-hate relationship with the New York mob that would ultimately lead to his death. Rosemary DeToma was 3 years older than Thomas. She was born in the neighbourhood of Ozone Park in 1961, to parents Michael and Marie. Michael was a security guard at a federal building in Manhattan, and Marie was a housewife. Rosemary was reportedly a happy child, who was street smart and a daddy's girl. However, when her father passed away suddenly, Rosemary was deeply affected by it, and her life took a turn for the worse. She argued often with her family, started to experiment with drugs, and got involved with a bad crowd. Her mother later stated that her daughter became a wild child after the death of her father. It wasn't long before Rosemary was in trouble with the law, and in 1986, at the age of 25, she was arrested by her own brother, New York City police officer Anthony DeToma, on suspicion of attempted robbery. Rosemary was later charged and sentenced to 15 months in the state penitentiary. It was just before she began her sentence that the young wild child met the love of her life, Thomas Hoover, and the pair would prove to be a match for each other. For both good and bad, they complemented each other's characters perfectly. Where Thomas was quiet and shy, Rosemary was outspoken and confident. And where Thomas was often more negative and pessimistic, Rosemary tended to be positive and optimistic. Rosemary also had a string of bad relationships with men, and Thomas was one of the first men to treat her with love and respect, which really bonded her to him. In 1987, when Rosemary was released from prison, the couple decided to tie the knot, and they were married a year later in 1988, despite strong opposition from Rosemary's policeman brother and her mother, who strongly disliked Thomas and the reputation he had as both a hothead and thief. On their wedding day, the pair posed for a photograph and looked very much in love. In the picture, they're both gazing towards the camera, their eyes locking with the viewer, holding each other gently in front of a simple red-bricked building, Thomas donning a dark suit and tie, and Rosemary wearing a white flowery dress. The couple appear to be incredibly optimistic for the future, as though they believed it was them against the world, Bonnie and Clyde. Unfortunately for the newlyweds, their married life didn't get off to a good start. Soon after the wedding, Thomas's father Anthony accidentally shot himself whilst cleaning a gun in his shop. He was rushed to hospital, but the wound was mortal, and despite the tremendous efforts of the doctors and medical staff, he died shortly after. The agony Thomas felt for the loss of his father was exacerbated when he learned that Anthony Hoover had left the flower shop in its entirety to his older brother. Thomas was absolutely devastated. He had so many fond memories of helping his father in the shop and couldn't believe he had been left out of the will. Thomas had been struggling on and off with drug addiction for many years, and the death of his father and the anger he felt over being cut out from the family business caused him to start abusing narcotics again. Unemployed and broke, Thomas fed his habit by committing house burglaries and breaking and entering into warehouses. However, in 1989, he was arrested during a botched burglary attempt and was imprisoned until his parole of May 1992. Rosemary was head over heels in love with Thomas, and his incarceration didn't change that. She visited him often in prison and waited patiently for him to get out, concentrating on making a home for him to come back to. She rented an apartment in her neighbourhood on Ozone Park's 83rd Street and found a steady job working for a collection agency in Manhattan. When Thomas was released 3 years later, Rosemary convinced her boss, Michael Schussel, to give her husband a chance. And her boss, feeling sympathetic to ex-offenders and wanting to help out the young couple, agreed. For a while, things went well. They enjoyed working together and hanging out in bars and clubs around Ozone Park. But money problems and Thomas's addiction sometimes caused the pair to bicker before making up. Soon after leaving prison and moving into Ozone Park with Rosemary, Thomas noticed the slick and suited mafia members around the neighbourhood, who would park their expensive Cadillacs up on the sidewalks, walk into their social clubs where they would drink endless espressos, play poker, or just hang out into the early hours of the morning. The mafia presence would cause a constant conflict of emotions to boil up within Thomas. He hated the mafia for how they had threatened and intimidated his father, but also admired them for their clothes, their cars, their power, and, most of all, their wealth. He wanted what they had, but knew that those kinds of people would never accept him into their world. And it started to make the 28-year-old feel bitter and resentful. He was a kid who was obsessed with the mafia, and she grew up in the neighbourhood and knew all those guys, screenwriter Jonathan Fernandez, who wrote one of the Hollywood movies based on the couple called Rob the Mob, said later of the pair. Thomas's boss at the collection agency, Michael, also testified years later that Thomas had asked for time off so he could attend one of the trials of mafia godfather John Gotti Sr. He was obsessed with the mob, he added. It was whilst observing the gangsters' comings and goings from their social clubs in Ozone Park that a plan formulated in Thomas's mind, a plan that would seemingly earn him the respect he felt he deserved, but would also solve all of his and Rosemary's money problems. Thomas decided he would rob the mafia's social clubs. The doors were always unguarded and left open, there would be a lot of cash inside, and the gangsters weren't going to call the police. He also had a machine gun hidden away in his apartment that he bought on the black market for protection. To the hothead Thomas, it seemed like the perfect crime. It is not known how Rosemary initially responded to her husband's heist plans. However, what is known is that in the summer and fall of that year, Rosemary acted as the getaway driver as Thomas robbed an estimated 4 to 10 mafia social clubs. The exact number isn't precisely known, as mafia rules forbid talking to law enforcement. Having grown up around the mafia all of her life, Rosemary must have known that robbing the mob would mean a death sentence when caught. But friends and family believed that she really loved Thomas and would have done anything for him, no matter how dangerous. There's virtually no greater insult than robbing the Gambino family where they socialised and hung out, federal prosecutor Joey Lipton said about the case decades later. Rosemary would drive the four-door maroon Mercury Topaz that had belonged to her late father and park it outside one of the social clubs late at night. And then Thomas, armed with an Uzi submachine gun, would burst through the doors and order the patrons to drop their jewellery and wallets into a sack. He then humiliated the mobsters further by forcing them to take off their clothes, leaving them in just their underwear before fleeing the scene. Thomas was so foolhardy he even refused to wear a mask during the robberies. It was almost a defiant act, as though he were daring the gangsters to find him. Rosemary would turn up for work after the hold-ups looking stressed and pale. She had trouble concentrating and once fainted in the office when she noticed an article in the newspaper about the heists, her ex-boss would later testify. However, although they may have felt scared or anxious for their lives, Rosemary and Thomas weren't inconspicuous with their newfound wealth. Always known for being strapped for cash and barely making the rent, the couple were seen splurging the money on extravagant shopping trips, gifts for family members, and Thomas was also seen sporting a Rolex watch. Ozone Park was a small, close-knit community, and it seemed as though Thomas was almost openly bragging that he was committing the robberies. His behaviour started to raise a lot of eyebrows in the neighbourhood. It would be their overconfidence, or perhaps their foolishness, that would prove to finally be their downfall when they decided to hold up a club for a second time. It was a mafia social club in Ozone Park called Cafe Liberty, dangerously close to where the Uvas lived. Cafe Liberty was also owned by a captain in the Gambino family, notorious hitman and loan shark, Dominic Skinny Dom Pisonia. He was rumoured to be one of the killers who shot Paul Castellano and his driver to death outside of Spark's Steakhouse in the Christmas holiday of 1985. Thomas and Rosemary had already robbed Pisonia's club a few months before, so Pisonia was enraged when Thomas burst through the doors of the club a second time, demanding cash and jewellery once more. One of the mafiosa sat down at a card table, allegedly told Thomas that he was a dead man walking for stealing from the Gambino family. But Thomas allegedly responded by roughing the old man's slicked back hair and telling him, "Everybody dies." He then fired multiple bullets into the ceiling of the club and fled. This time, however, Skinny Dom and others pursued Thomas outside and managed to get a good look at the getaway vehicle, noting down the car's make, model, and number plate as it sped away from the scene. By now, the mafia were beyond infuriated by the robberies of their social clubs, and an open contract was put out on Rosemary and Thomas's lives. Everyone in the neighbourhood was told to keep their eyes open for a four-door, maroon, Mercury Topaz. The deadly consequences they had avoided so far and fled successfully from were now tracking the young married couple down. It was the morning of Christmas Eve, and the Big Apple was experiencing a typical and bitterly cold December climate. Flurries of snow and biting winds. Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You was number one on the Billboard chart, and the streets were alive with Christmas illuminations flashing in storefront windows. The roads were congested with rush hour traffic, and on the sidewalks was the hustle and bustle of people, rushing to make last-minute purchases for their loved ones. Thomas and Rosemary had also decided to spend the day last-minute Christmas shopping, always broke and struggling to make the rent. This Christmas was very different. They had about $1,000 in stolen cash on them. In their 83rd Street apartment, they rushed around to get ready to leave, and then telephoned Thomas's mother, Fanny, briefly to wish her a Merry Christmas. At around 9 a.m, the pair were trying to stay warm inside the maroon Mercury Topaz listening to the radio. Rosemary behind the wheel and Thomas in the passenger seat as usual. The couple were excitedly discussing what they were going to buy in the city that day. At an intersection on 91st Street and 103rd Avenue, Rosemary pulled up to stop at a streetlight. While waiting for the lights to change to green, six gun blasts exploded through the congested intersection and echoed off the tenement buildings. Bullets shattered the windscreen and both Rosemary and Thomas were hit three times in the head. They were killed instantly and died next to each other. Pedestrians and drivers dived for cover. The Mercury Topaz rolled out of control through the intersection, sped down several blocks and crashed into another car, before being brought to a stop by a red brick wall at the bottom of 103rd Avenue. Onlookers rushed to the scene to try and help. but it was obvious to anyone who gazed into the blood-drenched vehicle that there was nothing anyone could do. The first police officers on the scene were baffled. The murders had the hallmarks of a contract killing, but authorities didn't yet understand why someone wanted Thomas and Rosemary killed in such a public and brutal fashion. Thomas's mother Fanny, the last person to speak to the couple alive, was one of the first people to accuse the Mafia, telling reporters at the time that it could only have been the Mafia who would commit such a brazen and cold-blooded murder at a busy intersection at 9 o'clock on a Thursday morning. Although she went on to insist that her son had no connection to the New York Mafia whatsoever, she said she had no idea why they would have wanted the couple dead. Rosemary's mother, Maria De Toma, was busily preparing a big Italian-style Christmas Eve dinner when her son, NYPD officer Anthony, came home in his blue uniform and sadly gave his mother the heartbreaking news. His little sister, her daughter, had been murdered only a few miles away from the house she grew up in. "My daughter used to love Christmas. For me, it will never be the same," Marie told reporters years later. With the aid of criminal informers and federal wiretaps, the authorities quickly pieced together the events that had led to the Christmas Eve slaying of the Uvers. However, they had no idea who the actual shooters had been, and according to the wiretapped recordings of secret Mafia meetings, the mobsters too were arguing over who should have gotten the credit for the murders. John Gotti Jr., the reputed head of the Gambino family, was recorded saying that the killing of Rosemary and Thomas was our trophy. Thomas and Rosemary were buried in separate ceremonies. Rosemary was interred with her father in Queens, and Thomas was laid to rest in the Bronx. When asked by a reporter why the married couple weren't being buried together, Rosemary's mother, Marie, simply shrugged and said, "My son didn't want her buried with him. What can I tell you?" When the police searched the Uvers' apartment, they found the Uzi submachine gun that Thomas had used in the robberies, as well as a hoard of expensive jewellery and cash. More importantly, in Thomas's wallet, they found a list of names and pager numbers of upper echelon mafiosa, which the FBI would later use to convict a number of gang members in a serious RICO case. NYPD detectives, with the help of the FBI, continued to try and solve the case, but with no collaborative witnesses, no strong leads, no proof except ballistics records, the case began to grow cold. It wasn't long before the murders of Rosemary and Thomas joined the hundreds of other cold cases, unresolved and unsolved, languishing in the files of a police department, swamped by an ever-increasing crime rate. It would take another 15 years for detectives to finally close the case, and for the families of Thomas and Rosemary to finally get something resembling justice for their loved ones. In September of 2005, FBI agents and NYPD detectives swooped in on 63-year-old Dominic Skinny Dom Pisonia and arrested him for the murders of Thomas and Rosemary Uver, as well as multiple other crimes. They also believed another mobster, who was a close friend of Pisonia, named Ronald "Ronnie" One-Arm Trucchio, who was already serving a lengthy sentence in federal prison, was the other killer in the 1992 cold case. The detective's theory was substantiated by a star witness, ex-Gambino captain and informant, Michael "Mikey" Scars De Leonardo, who testified that Pisonia and Trucchio had tracked the couple down using their vehicle's number plate and had then ambushed them on the morning of Christmas Eve 1992. De Leonardo told the authorities that Pisonia had committed the killings because he was infuriated that his club had been robbed twice by the Uvers and that his friends had been humiliated. He told the courts later he was very angry, as everybody else was, that these guys had the nerve to go around robbing clubs, like committing suicide. In May 2007, the silver-haired Pisonia was found not guilty of the Uvers' murders because the jury felt that the prosecution hadn't been able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he and Trucchio had in fact pulled the triggers. However, they did find Pisonia guilty of conspiracy to commit the murders of Rosemary and Thomas, and in September of 2007, the 65-year-old was sentenced to serve 15 years in a federal penitentiary. Rosemary's mother passed away in 2017 and was laid to rest with her husband and daughter. Her brother Anthony retired as a lieutenant with the New York City Transit Bureau. As for Thomas's family, it is believed they are still in the Bronx and the flower business, but they haven't spoken to the press about Pisonia's arrest or conviction. Dominic Pisonia was released early from prison due to poor health on the 15th of November 2019, at the age of 78. A lot has been said and written about Thomas and Rosemary Hoover, and it truly is a fascinating case. Their true motives will always be somewhat mystifying, but there are two things that are certain about the couple. They loved each other very much, and they both died truly brutal deaths.